Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's passage over the threshold, with enough Democrats now pledged to support the P5+1 deal with Iran, meaning the Republicans will not be able to override President Obama's veto of their expected rejection of the deal. Mansour Farhang, a professor of international relations at Bennington College, who resigned as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the UN and is the author of The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference, joins us. We will discuss the failure of the massive lobbying effort aimed at House and Senate Democrats and the symbiosis between rejectionists in the U.S. and hardliners in Iran opposed to the deal. Then we'll go to Geneva, Switzerland to speak with Joel Millman, a press officer for the International Organization for Migration, and discuss the European migration crisis as thousands more refugees from the Middle East arrive in Greece, while hundreds of refugees remain trapped at the main train station in Budapest, unable to join trains for Germany, even though they have tickets, where on top of their misery, they have to endure abuse from neo-Nazis belonging to Hungary's Jobbik party. Then finally, we will speak with Ronald Krodzinski, Jr., a constitutional law expert at the University of Alabama who has followed same-sex marriage cases, about the standoff in Kentucky where a clerk refuses to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, claiming her authority to defy the Supreme Court comes from God. And joining us now is Mansour Farhang, who is a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release the U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farhang.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And clearly there must be some kind of sigh of relief, particularly in the White House, that President Obama has reached the threshold where he will be able to override at least his opponents won't be able to override the veto that's expected of the P5+1 agreement by the U.S. Senate and House. So he's at, I believe, 34 now. I take it you'd like to see him get even more votes.
Definitely. I think it would be more interesting if you could get 41 votes. So when the Democrats engage in filibuster, there will not be 60 votes in order to put the issue on the agenda. So in that case, the Congress will not even get a chance to vote on it. But I should also add that it's not only a sigh of relief in the White House, but it is a sigh of relief on the part of overwhelming majority of Iranian people. Survey research shows that 83% of Iranians want to see a peaceful resolution of this conflict, but there is a minority, powerful and vocal minority in Iran, that have immense influence in the security and intelligence as well as propaganda agencies of the state. They are on the same side as the opponents of the agreement in the United States. So they are very disappointed that Obama is succeeding, but the Iranian people definitely identify with this success.
Well, when President Obama pointed out that symmetry, or that sort of rather ironic alliance, if you will, between hardliners on both sides, it certainly didn't go down well with his opponents here in the United States.
Sure. You know, there was convergence of interest. You know, it's very interesting that during the hostage crisis, that the convergence of interest between the Reagan-Bush campaign team in the summer of 1980 and the hostage takers in Iran reached the point that there was a serious suspicion that there was collusion between the two. And it ended up that the Congress of the United States investigated this issue, whether or not there was collusion, but I happened to testify at the time both before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House International Relations Committee, and my position was that there was convergence of interest between the two. Khomeini really wanted to see President Carter defeated. So did the Reagan-Bush campaign team. There was no need for them to get together. It's the same situation today. The hardliners in Iran have benefited from this, both economically as well as using this confrontation with the United States in order to suppress the dissidents. And the smuggling business, the billions of dollars have been involved in the smuggling business, and the Revolutionary Guards elements and security and intelligence people have been involved in it. So they're going to lose that opportunity. There is a serious, genuine division within the Iranian regime, and the hardliners in Iran are very disappointed that this conflict is coming to an end.
So in other words, back in 1980, there wasn't an October surprise so much as an October compact of interest or something along those lines.
Exactly. And in fact, this was the conclusion of the Congress of the United States appropriated $10 million to the study of this issue because the rumor was very strong. And Gary Sick actually wrote a book about it entitled The October Surprise, even though he didn't specifically accuse the Reagan-Bush campaign team of being involved in some kind of collusion, but the implication was there. The implication was there, and that implication was investigated. They didn't come up with any hard evidence, but there was no question that the convergence of interest was real, and both sides knew about it.
And Gary Sick, of course, was no lightweight. He sat at the head of the Iran desk on the National Security Council, both under President Carter and under President Reagan. Now, in the broader sense, though, surely, Mansour Farhang, that the success of the P5+1 deal with Iran would perhaps resonate amongst people around the world, and particularly, hopefully, more people than just people who follow political science and international relations, and that is that it will prove that you can get more and better security through diplomacy than you can by bombing people.
Yep. No question. As we know, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, and the rest, that's exactly what it led to, the division within the Iranian regime. And this agreement can actually pave the way for resolution of other conflicts, because it's in spite of the fundamental differences between the Iranian regime and the United States, they do have convergence, they do have strategic common interest. For example, in Iraq, they're both interested in stability. In Afghanistan, they're both interested in defeating, you know, the Taliban. And obviously, they're both interested in defeating the Daesh or the Islamic, you know, state. They have different motives, obviously. Iran and the United States do not have the same ultimate long-term objectives. But it's fascinating that when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, the first Iraqi troops entering Iraq came from 12,000 Iranian trained and equipped Al-Badr Brigade. They entered Iraq and the Bush administration accepted it. And they played a very destructive role, along with American forces, in ethnic cleansing of various cities. 4 million Iraqi refugees were created, and these 4 million ended up constituting the social base of the Islamic State. So this was the beginning. So at the same time, the Iranian regime has the potential to moderate its position. When Rouhani and Zarif came to power, their platform was actually normalization of Iran's relations with the rest of the world. So that potential is there. And if this agreement is going to pave the way for continuing discussion and negotiation between the United States concerning other issues, it could genuinely make a contribution to resolution of political conflicts in the Persian Gulf region. But that remains to be seen, both with respect to challenge facing Rouhani and Zarif in Iran, as well as President Obama in the United States.
And you mentioned the hardliners who are extremely upset inside Iran, and they've been very vocal lately. And I take it that they're really holding the Washington Post journalist, right? So, you know, a lot of conservatives in this country have argued that you could have got a better deal, and the first thing you should have done is get these people out, and President Obama tried to explain that that was simply handing a gift to the other side. If they could, you know, basically put obstacles in front of the negotiation, then that, you know, it's like diplomacy 101. That's really a boneheaded approach. So what's your sense then of how much the IRGC people and the Quds and these hardliners can sabotage this in any way, or are they going to have to go back into a box?
You see, first of all, with respect to these Americans arrested in prison in Iran, we have to know that the hardliners and the security and intelligence, they are pretty clever. They have arrested the four people who entered Iran with Iranian passports. According to Iranian laws, the dual nationality is not recognized. So they have arrested, as far as they're concerned, their own citizens. And from a legal point of view, the United States or the international community really doesn't have anything to say, you know, about that. And what they want is, because there are a number of Iranian agents who have been arrested and imprisoned in the United States for engaging in the kind of trade relations, purchasing certain equipments, military-related equipments, communication equipments for the Revolutionary Guards. They were arrested. There are three of them in Florida and in the United States. So what I understand is that the hardliners in Iran want to negotiate with the United States to exchange the prisoners, the Iranian prisoners in the United States, with the four American prisoners, you know, in Iran. And the fact that they decided to arrest the four of them, particularly Rezaian, at this particular moment, it was a way of creating anger and frustration in the American public as a way of preventing the success of this agreement. But that's definite. It's, you know, they don't have a social base in Iran. They don't have a social base, but they do have the guns. They do have the jails. They do have the torture chambers. So they are not going to go away. And the regime itself, including the people who are taking a more moderate position, they are still, it's still a totalitarian regime in the sense that they don't recognize any civil liberties in Iran. There is no political party. There is no opposition to the regime in Iran. So it's that someone like Khamenei wants to have both sides, wants to have the hardliners because they're important in regard to suppressing the dissident elements, human rights activists, the democracy activists in Iran. He needs the hardliners, but at the same time, they are faced with such a dead end with respect to economic issues and the political isolation of Iran that they also want to amend their ways, have some kind of rapprochement with the United States. So particularly Khamenei, the most powerful individual in Iran, he plays a double game. And all of his speeches are constructed in a way that he wants to please both the hardliners as well as the people who want a negotiated settlement and move toward a more moderate foreign policy. This is the nature of the regime. It is not the first time that an autocratic ideological regime is faced with a dilemma that they really, with respect to their own interests, they have to compromise. At the same time, the coercive apparatus of the state is extremely important to them in order to suppress the opposition.
So, Mansour Farang, clearly lately the New York Times has been making a lot of money from full-page ads of those opposed to the Iran deal, and AIPAC have been running these commercials on television, fairly blanketing them on the news channels like MSNBC, for example, but they're not working, clearly, if the president's got enough votes. I noticed in Wednesday's New York Times op-ed by Thomas Friedman, who I don't often agree with, that he castigated some of the generals that signed one of those full-page ads opposing the deal, pointing out that the hyperbole of saying that this is the most, Iran's the most dangerous country on the planet. And Friedman went on to point out that actually Saudi Arabia, our ally, has in fact caused infinitely more damage in the world. So, given that basically the rest of the world is on board this, with the exception of Israel, do you think the narrative is ever going to change here to recognize how our so-called ally Saudi Arabia has been responsible for not just the Islamic State and Daesh, but the Taliban, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and so on. I mean, the record is so clear, and but the hyperbole is out there, but it's obviously, as the days go by, it's going to look more and more hollow.
You see, during the Cold War, the United States was in support of Saudi Arabia's religious propagation because the religion was seen as an instant anti-communist force. And if we really want to pay attention to the very beginning of Saudi Arabian money creating the Al-Qaeda and the rest, we have to go back to the 1980s when the United States and Saudi Arabia contributed over $15 billion to the Mujahideen or the Taliban who were fighting the Russians in Afghanistan. The United States did a great deal of training and equipping, and Saudi Arabia did these madrasas in Pakistan that trained the Al-Qaeda people, the Taliban people. They were all paid for by Saudi Arabia, and the teachers had all received training in Saudi Arabia. So historically, the United States did not at all see Saudi Arabian religious fanaticism as a negative force in international relations. It is a reason, as a result of that force ending up being what it is today, the United States seems to have a second thought about Wahhabism or Saudi. Saudi Arabia has spent billions of dollars all over the world in propagating Wahhabism. There is no question about that. The comparison between Iranians have not really had any money. To the extent that Iran has been influential, it was, you know, the popular revolution in Iran at the time that for the first time in the history of the region, there was a popular revolution overthrowing an autocratic regime by the people themselves as a genuine popular uprising involving the liberals, the leftists in the country. Regrettably, the revolution ended up being hijacked by religious fundamentalists. But that revolution was really influential in the region, and the regime benefited from that. So if the Iranian regime moves toward a more moderate position and in the coming year lives up to its commitments to the nuclear agreement and its behavior actually changes, it could make a significant difference with respect to movement toward improvement of U.S.-Iranian relations and this anti-Iranian sentiment that we see in the United States, which is understandable given the irrational behavior of the Iranian regime for 37 years, hostage-taking Salman Rushdie, the war with Iraq, and threat against the existence of Israel and so forth. The propaganda of the Iranian regime has been atrocious. We have to see if, as a result of this agreement, that propaganda is going to change or be significantly, you know, diminished. But I would say in Iran, the popular support for Rouhani and this agreement is going to be really very influential in the deep direction of Iran's foreign policy in the coming month and years. And that would be the kind of force that would actually prove what Friedman is talking about in that article, that Iran's opposition, Iran's is more politically motivated. It's more nationalistically oriented, even though they use religious vocabulary, because they have good relationship with North Korea. They have good relationship with China. They have good relationship with Russia. While Saudi Arabia's foreign policy, particularly in the region, is much more ideologically and religiously oriented. That has to come an end if this religious fanaticism that is, you know, plaguing the Middle East. Saudi Arabian money is at the root of this barbarism in the region, and the United States should persuade Saudi Arabia to put an end to this propagation of Wahhabism, which has created this massive barbaric regime in the region. You know, it's very difficult to understand what has happened exactly, but the Saudi resources and propaganda played a significant role in creating it.
Well, Mansour Farhang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mansour Farhang, who's a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release the U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, the Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Geneva, Switzerland to speak with the press officer for the International Organization for Migration. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Geneva, Switzerland, is Joel Millman, who's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration, who previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Millman.
Thanks for having me.
And there's about 2,000 people camped at the Budapest train station. They've got tickets to Germany, but they're not being allowed to move. And they're being abused by the right-wing Jobbik party protesters. So this sort of highlights a lack of coordination, it would seem, within the Europeans. The Germans appear to be welcoming, so why are the Hungarians preventing these people from moving on?
Well, it's not a simple matter of why one does and why one doesn't. Hungary has been kind of an outlier this year. It's not as though they don't have an argument. There were 6 months ago, they complained bitterly about people abusing the asylum system who weren't even from outside Europe. We're talking about Kosovars and Serbians who were using the Hungarian route to get to Germany. And, you know, the Hungarians took a very strong stand that the rules are the rules, and these were not even people, you know, fleeing war in the Middle East or Africa, but they were our neighbors, but they had to, go by the rules of the EU. They saw themselves as, you know, good, faithful members and being ignored. And, you know, this was kind of a tense situation that played into some, domestic politics in the country. Now they get this wave, which nobody in Europe expected. We're up to almost 250,000 coming into Greece. And logically, from Greece, they have to go up to the Balkans, and that takes them to Hungary as well. So it was kind of a double whammy for them, and of course we're not happy with the response of hooligans or anybody who abuses migrants, and much less those who fall into the hands of smugglers who transport them in deadly circumstances, which had happened last week. But just to give you some context, this has been kind of brewing in that one country for all of this year, and it is a marked contrast to some of the progress that's being made across the EU, particularly Germany, like you say.
But meanwhile, more and more people are pouring into Greece, coming and into Italy, coming from North Africa and risking their lives crossing the oceans. 4,000 immigrants just arrived in mainland Greece from the island of Lesbos overnight. So, in other words, there's more in the pipeline. So doesn't this put further pressure on European governments? I know they've been meeting to try and come up with some joint plan here, but reality on the ground seems to be outstripping the politicians.
Well, that's the truth. And also, you know, you're starting to see kind of an agglomerative effect. And, as we used to say at the Wall Street Journal, you know, business begets more business. And, you know, fascinatingly enough, for those who study these patterns, Syrians were the largest single group that left Libya last year, 45,000. This year, they're well under 10,000, but they've been replaced from Libya by lots of new countries, mostly in sub-Saharan West Africa. It's actually slightly ahead of last year's pace for leaving Libya. We're up to about 115,000. I think we were about 110,000 this time last year. So it's slightly ahead, but even without 30,000 Syrians, there's been other new players coming in, kind of like a market frenzy. I mean, it's as though they believe the door's going to close behind them and they won't get to Europe. And in a way, we think that they're maybe creating the conditions that they're actually concerned about, which the migrants, that is, because Europe and the African Union are going to have a summit meeting, and I think they're going to begin to say, how can we manage this globally, not as something that we throw up our hands and say Libya has no government to deal with. What can we do? I mean, they see what's happening when everyone starts rushing for the exits. We're also getting similar reports out of Afghanistan. The Afghan population that's coming across Turkey into Greece is not quite at the level of the Syrians, which is about 88,000 this year, but it's pretty high. It's 32,000 through July, and we know possibly through June. And we hear from our people who work in Kabul that the authorities there are issuing passports at a rate of 5,000 a day in Kabul. So Afghans are also on the move, and you have to wonder how much of this has become like a vortex. You know, you hear about so much activity and so many people are hitting Greece and hitting the islands and then moving up through Europe. You know, how many more countries in the world are going to say, it's our chance, this is our chance, and we're going to hit the exits? And I think that's what Europe and everybody is looking at and trying to come up with a really good solution if they can.
And again, I'm speaking with Joel Millman, who's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, Switzerland. He previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. But the question that arises here, Joel, is that given the enormous burden that Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey have already taken on with millions of Syrian refugees, about half of the population in Syria is displaced from this bloody civil war, and apparently Turkey spent something like $5 billion so far, and they simply can't keep up. And so one would ask the question, why then did the Europeans and the United States, who are the main funders of this kind of humanitarian relief, why don't they spend their money on the ground where the crisis is and try and figure a way, if you can't solve the Syrian civil war, at least you can allow the people who are fleeing the immediate violence to live in a kind of semi-decent way until there is some kind of peace settlement?
Well, some of that has happened. I mean, there's actually even been articles in the New York Times by the architectural critic discussing the sort of the state of art refugee camp that has emerged, you know, from the Syrian conflict. You know, of course, Syria's neighbors have been extremely generous, Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey, like you mentioned. But at IOM, we talk about two poles, you know, two magnetic poles that are pulling against each other and complementing each other. Europe has a plummeting birth rate and yet an enormous need for youthful labor, both skilled and unskilled. And North Africa, the Middle East, Central Sub-Saharan Africa are marked by enormously skilled generation of literate, sometimes computer literate youth that have finished school. So in some countries, the first time in generations that there's been peace, and yet these countries can't produce jobs fast enough for all this talent. And this is, you know, something that we've seen before in recent history in China and India and Brazil. I mean, countries that did a good job bringing peace and stability and education, but just couldn't really produce the jobs fast enough for that generation. So the fact that it's so close to Europe, these opposites now attract. That Europe needs the labor and the countries south of Europe and east of Europe need the jobs. So that's going to happen. It's being spurred by horrendous civil war and civil conflict in a lot of countries. But we think this pattern would be emerging around this time in the century anyway. So it's really a time for both sides to sit down and say, this is a very broad trend. You know, how do we manage it? How do we get the best out of it for both the sender country and the destination country? And there are many ways to do it. I mean, there are elements of the service industry that can be treated almost like agriculture, you know, a five-month visa, and you come in and you're a caregiver for the elderly. It's not a job that that everybody wants to do, but millions of people would do it, especially if they worked intensively for 5 months and then went home, and then someone just like them from their country, possibly from their own family, came and did the job in their absence. They're what we call shared labor operations. And this would soak up an enormous amount of demand and solve problems that Europe has, you know, filling those positions. So there are solutions to be worked out. They're going to take some radical thinking, but I think Europe's capable of it. And this crisis is really pushing them towards, you know, thinking as creatively as they can.
So in terms of the work that you've done on human trafficking, Joel Millman, what is the law enforcement sort of curve there between enforcement getting a handle on them and criminals being ingenious as they are? They're usually much more proactive, and police tend to be reactive. From what I know from that horrendous incident that took place in Austria recently, where the 71 bodies were found inside the refrigerated truck that was supposed to be hauling chicken from Slovenia. The people that the people that were rounded up there were real small fry, some Bulgarians and an Afghan. So what's your sense of whether, just like the drug trade, that they're rolling up the little guys, the street dealers, and not getting the kingpins?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, you know, we go down to Lyon every now and again, which is very close to Geneva, and talk to Interpol, try to get a handle on stuff like this. And you know, people say, police here say that you got to have a partner on the other side of the Mediterranean. You've got to have somebody in Cairo or Tripoli that you can ring up on the phone, and that guy's going to act on your information. Most of that part of the world, the law enforcement in Europe doesn't have a partner. Look, there have been some successes. A few months ago, we thought the next wave of this migrant arrival was going to be something called the ghost ships, where operators in Turkey were buying these enormous freighters that were ready to be knocked down to scrap steel and filling them up. I think the biggest one had 800 people on it, possibly 900. They were arriving Christmas week last week when, you know, it was kind of a lull in government operations, and they were hitting the beaches in Italy. And we thought this was going to be 2015's big trend. There's no more fishing boats with 100 people, but big freighters with 800 to 1,000 people. And three of them did arrive, and then it just stopped. And from what we understand, Turkish authorities acted very swiftly to police the selling of these vessels so they couldn't end up in smugglers' hands. And Egypt this year, which had a notorious sinking about a year ago in September last year, Egypt this year has been extremely quiet for this kind of thing. So we know that there is progress being made. It's a country like Syria or Libya where there really is a vacuum of authority. Then you really have no partner to work with. And we've talked to police officials who can tell us, you know, based on photos that show up on Facebook pages, they know where the safe house is in Libya. They know where it is in Morocco because they can tell by street signage or license plates on the cars in the picture. And there's just no one they can get to act. They can't get anybody to act locally on the ground to do something. In fact, we've even seen, you know, torture videos sent from people's cell phones in some of these places. So they have plenty of evidence, but they have to have an enforcement power to dance with.
Well, we have seen, obviously, we're seeing footage from the main train station in Budapest that's pretty ugly. And I saw footage of some of the Syrian refugees making their way. And, you know, the Hungarians have put up a razor wire fence between Hungary and Serbia, but those that could still make their way around them, these are people who hadn't eaten or even drunk anything for days. I mean, this human suffering is pretty palpable. But prior to all of this, we also saw a lot of, you know, really ugly stuff going on in Calais of these sort of, you know, temporary camps that have become permanent housing for all of these refugees wanting to get into England, and they risk their lives and cut through the fence and dash into the tunnel. And so, again, it's not, you know, you keep seeing the stories, but you just don't get a sense that anybody has a handle on this.
Well, you know, there's an element to this which is eternal, and it's gone on in immigrant writing and immigrant reporting for 200 years, from what I can tell. Very voyeuristic, very, can you believe what people will do to change their lives and come live with us? And And, you know, it kind of flatters the North. It flatters the developed world because you see these dramatic stories of people that, you know, deserve our pity, and they seem just so pathetic. But look how hard they'll work to join us. And I used to worry about that as a newspaper reporter, how much we were feeding a kind of voyeuristic view. And is that what it then becomes, you know, just an entertainment value as opposed to really considering what are the broad themes in human history that are happening, you know, right in front of our eyes right now. But I think we can say that it's been a very trying year and a half for Europe. But we were talking about it in the office, you know, the IOM this week, that Europe really did do a U-turn earlier this year when they decided they didn't want to rescue people at sea anymore, and groups like ours pointed out how deadly that policy was unfolding. And they did a U-turn. They turned around and put those boats back out, and they've saved tens of thousands of people ever since. So you're tempted to despair and say, how will it be solved? But then you look micro, and there are solutions unfolding every day that show the flexibility of these governments, and people are serious about grappling with this and coming up with a solution. So I guess I'm more optimistic than pessimistic now.
So what is happening with the in the North Africa Mediterranean passages? And we still hear stories of people being crammed into holes and either drowning or dying of asphyxiation because they just pack people in like sardines. Are they destroying the boats when they capture them and take the people
sometimes,
off?
Sometimes. Well, some of these boats are already foundering when the ships get to them. We don't take very seriously this idea of we're going to sink the boats and it's going to make a dent, because, you know, often the boats are already sinking when the rescue ships come. It's just one of these moments. You know, we were compiling statistics today with our chief of mission in Libya. I was on the phone with him, and we're talking about the sudden rise of Moroccans, Pakistani, and Bangladesh nationals coming out on these boats, which we didn't see a year ago. Those were countries that generally didn't show up, and the mystery is why. Is this the last gasp? Are they squeezing the last national, you know, third country nationals out of Libya? The gangs terrorizing them, or have they been kidnapped and brought to Libya, or are they people that are just fed up and they can't wait for a repatriation flight that IOM often arranges? You know, we just don't know, but we're trying to grope towards an understanding of, you know, is this sort of cresting? Is this peaking now? Is this almost done? Because they're actually getting new groups of people that we haven't seen before on these boats. And, you know, we hope we have some answers in a few days, because it's really hard to investigate, you know, what's happening in Libya from a place like Geneva. But, you know, our people are out there asking questions and talking to diplomats and talking to aid workers and talking to the survivors themselves, you know, and seeing, how did you get here? How did you get on this boat? And, you know, within a few days, I hope we have a picture and we can share that.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Joel Millman, given that Hungary seems to be taking a hard-line stance, and I know that it's a fairly right-wing government of Viktor Orban, but it's also being attacked on its right by the sort of neo-Nazi kind of Jobbik party that's already been very, very cruel towards gypsies, etc., and now they're beating up on these unfortunate refugees from the Middle East. So I would imagine that as this situation continues, that there'll be more and more backlash from these European right-wing political parties like Jobbik in Hungary and the National Front in France, etc. Is this feeding into their kind of nationalistic right-wing narrative?
Yes, but I mean, you could also argue. I saw an extraordinary piece in the New York Times today by Tom Edsel about how Trump is reaping 50 years of Republican politics, you know, trying to make that party a white person's party. Sometimes the backlash isn't what you think. It isn't going to bolster the fortunes of those extreme parties. It's going to harden the resistance against them. So we try not to meddle too much in the domestic affairs of these democracies, but I guess we accept the fact that there are going to be strong opinions. I mean, immigration, extremely threatening. It threatens people's identity. It threatens their fear of job loss. I mean, We believe it's on the whole positive and inevitable, but that's a hard sell for people who are already scared and who are easily manipulated, as voters are. Where we're disappointed is when politicians realize, you know, they can buy votes on the backs of these migrants, because migrants are pretty powerless in their societies, and they can't vote, and they often can't even work in some of these countries. So it becomes a natural thing for a regulation to fall heaviest on them, and politicians to feel like they pay the least penalty by pandering to those who are resisting the migration trend. But there is a point where the tips back, where just the rest of the voting public is kind of revulsed by this. And we've seen it in Germany this week, big banners at football matches where they say, welcome refugees. And we've seen kind of ad hoc Airbnbs starting up to match people who would take a migrant into his home for a few nights, with migrants who want to, just want to get a good night's sleep,
sure,
and not have to stay in the bus station. So that's pretty encouraging, too.
Right. Well, Joel Bilbert, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, and we'll do it again sometime.
Thank you. We will. And again, I've been speaking with Joel Milman, who's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, Switzerland. He previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the standoff in Kentucky, where a clerk refuses to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, claiming her authority to defy the Supreme Court comes from God. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ronald Krodzinski, Jr., who's a constitutional law expert at the University of Alabama, who has followed same-sex marriage cases. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronald Krodzinski, Jr.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And the clerk in Kentucky who's refusing gay couples marriage licenses, is obviously that we've all seen it on television, the exchange with these very frustrated and angry couples who are being denied marriage licenses, and under what authority, the couples ask her, and she says under God's authority. So do you think God's going to win this argument?
Oh, well, I don't want to go there, but I think in terms of the legal merits, Davis has very, very little chance of ultimately prevailing. I think we know how this is going to come to an end. The couple seeking marriage licenses in Rowan County are going to get them. The question of a public official's ability to refuse to perform her official duties is not one we see very often, because it almost never happens. Whatever the merits of a faith-based exemption for people acting in a private capacity, the argument in favor of letting a public official pick and choose whom she'll serve and what constitutional rights she'll respect is just not one that's going to resonate at all in the federal courts.
Well, her attorney and her defenders, including the Republican candidate for governor of Kentucky, they say this is her First Amendment right. And my understanding is that we all privately have First Amendment rights, but if you are a public employee, I can't imagine that it's your First Amendment right not to perform your job.
Right. As a private citizen, like any other private citizen, she's entitled to hold and maintain whatever religious belief she finds persuasive and congenial. But she's not acting as a private citizen. She's acting as a duly elected official of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Suppose that her religion taught that God disfavored interracial marriage. Would she be permitted under this theory to deny interracial couples marriage licenses? You know, the logic of this is quite frightening. What if a general asked to plan a battle, said, well, this battle is offensive to my religious principles, I'm not going to do it? What if an IRS official who was passing on an application for tax-exempt status for a religious group said, oh, this group peddles in the rankest of heresies. They're not a religious group. I'm not, you know, my conscience precludes me from approving their 501c3 status. I mean, it's a path to madness if we were to embrace this kind of logic. Now, to be clear, there are some more limited ways we could accommodate faith-based objections. For example, I'm not sure Ms. Davis personally has to hand the gay and lesbian couples the licenses. She could have a subordinate process these applications, for example. But the idea that her office, as a government office, can claim a religious objection to honoring a constitutional right held by local citizens is just legal nonsense, nonsense on stilts.
But Kentucky law shields an elected official like Ms. Davis from being forced out of her post, and the only way that can be done is through an election, and it's not likely, or at least there's some doubt as to whether the voters of this conservative state would remove her through the ballot. And the other alternative is impeachment through the state legislature, and that's equally unlikely from my understanding.
Well, I have great faith in the persuasive authority of Judge David Bunning down there in the Eastern District of Kentucky. He's got a contempt hearing scheduled for tomorrow. I suspect he'll give Ms. Davis a few days to think about her position and to come into compliance. It would be unusual for a judge to immediately impose civil contempt sanctions. But I think by early next week at the latest, Davis and her office will be looking at very serious fines for every day that she fails to comply with the lawful order of the district court. An order, I might add, that was effectively affirmed by the Sixth Circuit unanimously by a three-judge panel that included an appointee of George W. Bush. The Sixth Circuit said that there was the standard they were applying was, does Davis have a high probability of success on the merits? That's the standard for an emergency stay. Instead of answering that question, the court answered a different one. It said that basically there is no merit whatsoever to her contentions. So they essentially sort of gave a preview of the merits. And again, this was not a particularly liberal panel. There was a very conservative Bush appointee who joined the unanimous panel decision to deny Davis a stay. So Davis may continue to hold office, but the federal district judge in Moorhead is going to increasingly ratchet up the sanctions until Davis either, I suppose, complies with the court's lawful order, or she could resign. We saw this in Mississippi. There was a county clerk in Grenada County, Mississippi, who back on June 30th said that the Bible is her final authority and that the Supreme Court's decision violated her core values. And so what did this clerk do? She resigned. And frankly, if Ms. Davis can't reconcile her religious beliefs with her official duties, she should take a page from Linda Barnett and resign her post.
And again, I'm speaking with Ronald Krodzinski, Jr., a constitutional law expert at the University of Alabama who has followed same-sex marriage cases. And we're talking about the clerk in Kentucky who's refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. And but these legal sanctions that you mention, and by the way, as you say, Judge Bunning was appointed by President George W. Bush, and he's the son of the former Republican Senator Jim Bunning. So, and the same is true with the Court of Appeals judges, that these are very conservative judges who are upholding the law, and since she has run her course in terms of appeals going all the way to the Supreme Court. So, but these sanctions that you mentioned that are likely to come from Judge Bunning's ruling, are they personal against her or against her office?
They'll run against her office, which means the people of Rowan County will be footing the bill for her defiance of the federal court. Now, as you suggested, she was elected, although she wasn't overwhelmingly elected. I think she got something like 53 or 54% of the vote. I suspect that people's attitudes will change when scarce financial resources are going to a federal district court bank account rather than to paving roads and paying for schools and maintaining the quality of life in Rowan County. or I could be naive in thinking that, but I clerked for Frank Johnson Jr., who was a fairly iconic civil rights judge in Montgomery, Alabama. He was on the district court and then on the Court of Appeals. President Carter elevated him. And he handed down a lot of major civil rights cases. And one of his big battles was with George Wallace over voting records in Dallas County. And Wallace swore he would never give in, and that he would defend Alabama's sovereignty to the death. Well, in the dark of night, he dumped the records on Judge Johnson's porch. I'm not making this up. That's essentially what happened in order to avoid being found in contempt of court. In fact, he actually asked Judge Johnson through an intermediary, could I go to jail for 2 or 3 days? That would be great for my political ambitions. And the judge told him through the intermediary that if he wanted to find out what contempt would be like, he would have to find out. So Wallace capitulated. Federal courts do not take kindly to being defied. Their record is pretty good at using civil contempt sanctions effectively to force compliance. If we look at massive resistance to desegregation in the South, public officials in the South were brought to book, and integration was no more popular in places like Alabama or Mississippi than same-sex marriages in Rowan County, Kentucky today. So I'm confident the courts will be able to resolve this in a way that ensures marriage licenses are available to all. We've been to this rodeo in a different context.
Well, Ms. Davis, apparently, in effect, she was elected, and you mentioned not by much of a margin, but she took office in January, succeeding her mother, who had been the county clerk for 37 years. So it's sort of almost dynastic in that sense. But apparently she's also, since she took her post, has also refused licenses to heterosexual couples. Are you aware of this, and on what grounds would that be?
Sure. It's an argument that about 11 probate judges in Alabama, by the way, are not really judges. They handle some judicial functions, but they hand out car tags and record property liens and also handle marriage applications. The legal argument is a pretty specious one. It's that if I don't give licenses to anyone, I'm not violating the Equal Protection Clause. Once again, there's instructive precedent from the civil rights era. A county in Virginia tried to do this, Prince Edward County. And in the Griffin case, the Supreme Court said, even though Virginia did not require every county to operate public schools, there was some discretion there under state law, if the county ceased operating public schools in order to evade a desegregation order, that reason was itself constitutionally invalid. And therefore, the policy of not offering public education to any children, white or black, was invalid. Griffin seems squarely on point here. Even if in Alabama, for example, where the statute says probate judges may rather than must issue marriage licenses, if the reason you use discretion is to avoid complying with the Constitution, that decision is itself unconstitutional. And as I understand Kentucky law, her obligation to issue marriage license is not discretionary. But even if it were, I don't think it makes a legal difference, because the reason she's not issuing marriage licenses to anyone is to avoid recognizing the equal protection and due process rights of same-sex couples in Rowan County.
Well, of course, this is already because of cable television and the fact that we live in the media age, 24/7 coverage. It's already become a kind of bit of a political circus, and she certainly had more than her 15 minutes of fame here, and it's likely to get ugly because a number of people have gone on television pointing out that that Ms. Davis has been divorced 3 times and that she was impregnated by a man who was not her husband, who she later married, making it the 4th marriage. So there's a either she's going to be sort of trashed, which obviously she is being, or on the other hand, she may become a kind of martyr for conservative and religious causes and maybe out there appearing in mega churches as a martyr. So that's one of the strange things about these issues, don't you think, that in many ways, and here we are with an election going on, that a lot of the candidates, you get the impression that they're also out there on the stump to enhance their media profile. So do you have a feeling that this is just another media circus?
Well, again, drawing from Alabama's experience, we have a Chief Justice of our Supreme Court, Roy Moore, who made national headlines both as a trial judge and later as Chief Justice by maintaining a copy of the Ten Commandments first in his chambers as a state trial judge and then on a large monument located in the state judicial building, and more as Chief Justice of the state, defied orders of the local federal courts requiring removal of the monument. He was ultimately removed from office by the state Judicial Ethics Committee, but he rode back in glory to the Chief Justiceship the last time the position was open. So I think you're exactly right to posit that If Ms. Davis has larger political ambitions in Kentucky, this may not be entirely a bad thing. Going to the question of contempt, and I have no inside information about this. If I were a law clerk to Judge Bunning, or if I were Judge Bunning, I would probably think long and hard about the wisdom of jailing her as a contempt sanction. That would be one possibility. I think doing that rather than imposing fairly jaw-dropping fines would not be the best way of securing compliance. There's been some talk about whether she will go to jail. I think that's very unlikely. I think it's much more likely that financial coercion will be brought against the office in a way that forces the public in Rowan County to swallow hard and think about whether this is a battle they really want to fund with their scarce dollars.
But how do you think this, just in closing, how do you think this plays into the broader issue of religious freedom, which of course has become an issue and it's certainly still alive? I mean, we had the Hobby Lobby decision at the Supreme Court, and after the gay marriage ruling came down, conservatives felt that that was a strong reed to hang their case on. And there seems to still be some sympathy for that sort of line of legal argument that people's religious freedoms should not be, no one can argue that they're being infringed, but I guess to some extent they feel that they're being insulted.
You're quite right, I think, in making that observation. I guess the distinction I would propose is one between failing to provide a mandatory government service due to an accommodation and reassigning tasks within a government office that does not in any way, shape, or form affect the basic availability of the service. So if a state wanted to provide a conscious exemption for a public employee with respect to any religious matter, I think that would probably be constitutionally acceptable. The Supreme Court has upheld RFRA against a constitutional establishment clause challenge. But I think the focus needs to be on whether citizens are able to obtain government services reliably and on the exact same terms and conditions as any other citizen, without fear, favor, or prejudice. So long as that is maintained, I don't have or see any major constitutional objection to providing limited exemptions for people of faith. This is not what Kim Davis is proposing. What she is seeking to do is to essentially close off the service that her office is supposed to offer to all citizens as a result of her personal faith commitment. This is simply not a constitutionally permissible route to take. As a government official performing an official government duty, she does not get to pick and choose which citizens and which constitutional rights she will honor and which she will disdain.
Well, Ronald Kretodinsky Jr., I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Enjoy speaking with you.
Likewise, and I think we learned a lot, so I'm very appreciative. And again, I've been speaking with Ronald Kretodinsky Jr., who is a constitutional law expert at the University of Alabama, who has followed same-sex marriage cases. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.